Chapter 9. Fat versus Obesity. Pay attention to what textbooks say about why fat cells get fat, not what they say about obesity. Through the 1960s and into the 70s, understanding human metabolism and fat storage became textbook science, even as the authorities, who were telling us how to eat healthy, focused on too much food causing obesity and too much dietary fat causing heart disease, continued to find it of little interest. This understanding has mostly stayed textbook science. Go to your local medical library or college bookstore or bookshelf if you're a physician, and find a biochemistry textbook or an endocrinology textbook published after, say, 1980. Look up fuel metabolism and insulin. In some textbooks, you might have to look under the word adipocyte, the technical term for a fat cell, or adipose tissue. Then go to the pages specified, and that textbook will explain the hormonal regulation of fuel metabolism. And since fuel storage is part of that process, it should explain what makes our fat cells store fat. It will do so in technical terminology. But the message will be that insulin drives fat storage in the context of the elevated blood sugar that comes with either eating a carb-rich meal or type 2 diabetes. Footnote. Even biochemistry and endocrinology textbooks tend to drift with the prevailing research fashions. Some simple truisms get left behind. In this case, as medical science embraced first molecular biology, then genomics and proteomics, and other disciplines made possible by the latest technological innovations, even gut biomics, the study of the bacteria colonizing our GI tracts, textbooks have begun to omit some of this basic science. Here's the 2017 edition, for instance, of Leninger Principles of Biochemistry, widely considered the most authoritative biochemistry textbook, from the summary of a section on hormonal regulation of fuel metabolism. High blood glucose elicits the release of insulin, which speeds the uptake of glucose by tissues and favors the storage of fuels as glycogen and triacylglycerols while inhibiting fatty acid mobilization in adipose tissue. Here's a less technical translation. High blood sugar, which you can have when you either are diabetic or have eaten a carb-rich meal, will prompt your pancreas to secrete insulin, which in turn will prompt you to burn the carbohydrates for fuel, store glucose as glycogen and fat, and prompt your fat cells to store the fat you've eaten and the fat made from glucose and hold on to the fat it already has. As a reminder of the power of paradigms and dogmatic thinking, the same textbook, on the very same page, 939, says, "To a first approximation, obesity is the result of taking in more calories in the diet than are expended by the body's fuel-consuming activities." The implication is that our fat cells get fat and fatter because our blood sugar goes up and insulin is elevated, but we get fat and fatter because we eat too much. These are entirely different mechanisms, even though you'd think that we'd get fat and fatter for the same reason our fat cells do. It is, after all, our fat cells that are getting fatter. I hesitate to use diagrams from human metabolism textbooks in a book meant to be listenable for most anyone, but since this is precisely what we want to know, I'm going to do it this one time. Please refer to the PDF that comes with this program. We want to know what regulates fat accumulations in fat cells, since, as Brooke noted, when we're overweight or obese, we're dealing with excess fat accumulation in, well, fat cells. Here's how this science looks in a diagram from the 2019 edition of the textbook Metabolic Regulation in Humans, written by Keith Frayne of Oxford University with Rhys Evans. Before Frayne retired a few years ago, he was considered among the two or three leading authorities in the world on metabolism and particularly fat metabolism. You can ignore the technical terminology in the diagram and pay attention to the bold arrows that I've added to the figure. As you can see, everywhere the fat tissue is taking up fat, it's insulin that's promoting it. insulin plus, as it's labeled. When the fat tissue is mobilizing fat, getting fat out of the cells and into the circulation where it can be used for fuel, it's insulin that's inhibiting it, insulin minus, and other hormones, adrenaline, noradrenaline, and ANP in the diagram, that are doing the promoting. Frayn's metabolic regulation, too, goes on to blame human obesity on eating too much. The first time I interviewed Frayn in February 2009 and mentioned that he seemed to have two different mechanisms for excess fat accumulation in fat cells and excess fat accumulation in humans, his immediate response, as I recall it, and I hope I'm not doing him a disservice, was that he had never considered that before. Metabolism researchers like to say that insulin is the signal for the fed state, meaning that it's a signal that we've eaten and we have fuel available to store and use for energy. That actually oversimplifies the reality. Insulin is the signal that the body has been fed carbohydrates. The fat we eat won't stimulate insulin secretion. While amino acids from protein are converted into glucose and stimulate insulin secretion indirectly, the protein will also stimulate, as I said, glucagon and growth hormone secretion. So that signal is far more nuanced. When carbohydrates are consumed and insulin is secreted, it's the carbohydrates that are used for energy and fat that is put in fat cells. So long as we keep eating carbohydrates, and those carbohydrates are absorbed into the circulation, so long as insulin remains elevated and the fat cells remain sensitive to that insulin, it will ensure that fat continues to be stored and to accumulate. One obvious implication of this basic human physiology is that if we want to get fat out of our fat cells in any biologically efficient way, we have to keep the insulin levels in our circulation low. We have to create that negative stimulus of insulin deficiency, which means not eating carbohydrates. It's all surprisingly simple if we work from the assumption, I would think a very reasonable one, that human physiology, biochemistry, and endocrinology are actually relevant to a problem like obesity and why we get fat. The authorities, for the past half century, have not done that. What's both fascinating and dismaying about this history is that virtually everyone involved in the diet, weight control, and health business since the 1960s got at least something important wrong. This was one of the many factors that worked to make a simple message appear to be complicated. Invariably, these people made some assumptions based either on their preconceptions about gluttony and sloth, or on the role of dietary fat in heart disease. Some were simply enamored by the physics of thermodynamics and couldn't get away from the idea that what entered the body in excess, whatever that meant, had to be stored as fat. These biases led them to make significant errors in how they interpreted all this evidence. It didn't help that many of these experts had little meaningful scientific training. Typically, they were medical doctors who got little more mentoring in doing good science than do plumbers or any other talented artisans. Most of those who had been mentored in science weren't particularly good at it. They didn't understand what it meant to be skeptical of their own ideas, and so to check and triple-check their assumptions. The first principle of science, as the Nobel laureate physicist Richard Feynman put it so aptly, is that you must not fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. As a result, these observations about the role of insulin and the implications that carbohydrates are fattening, specifically to those who are predisposed to fatten easily, were never taken seriously or considered relevant. They simply didn't fit with the misconceived nutritional notions of the era. When they were taken into account, invariably the researchers interpreted them simplistically and incorrectly. By 1965, for instance, as low-carb diets were becoming increasingly popular and the science to explain why they worked, as if by magic, had been mostly elucidated, the nutritionists were already saying that the proclamations of physicians advocating for these diets were either nonsense, no one can lose weight without eating less, or that the diets themselves were deadly all that saturated fat, and that the public dissemination of this dietary guidance would result in mass murder, as Harvard's Jean Mayer had suggested to the New York Times in 1965. Mass murder. Mayer made that statement while clearly understanding the role of insulin in fat accumulation. Insulin favors fat synthesis, he wrote in his 1968 book, Overweight, while speculating that different levels of insulin and other hormones might have different effects on the fat content of the body. But Mayer couldn't leave energy balance behind, and convinced himself that those who are fat ultimately get that way by being physically inactive. The passion for physical fitness that Mayer helped promote began in the United States in the 1970s and is still going strong, coincident with ever higher rates of obesity and diabetes. The dietitians who were studying and reporting on the remarkable efficacy of LCHF ketogenic eating, weight loss free from hunger, seemed uninterested in discussing mechanisms that could explain this remarkable efficacy. If they paid attention to this science, they rarely, if ever, talked or wrote about it publicly. Researchers who actually studied obesity would later latch on to the idea that the fat we eat is the fat we store, as it mostly is, and this, coupled with the notion being widely promulgated that dietary fat caused heart disease, led them to advise us to eat less fat and replace it with carbohydrates, and that we'd prevent fat accumulation by doing so. This might even work in some people, but at a cost that might be exceedingly difficult to pay for a lifetime. They never made it to the next step in the process, which is that the carbohydrates we eat work to regulate through insulin that fat storage process, and so how much of that dietary fat our fat cells will store and for how long. One influential researcher even floated a hypothesis implying that the body so preferred storing fat to carbohydrates thermodynamically that if a food didn't have fat in it, then it couldn't or wouldn't make us fat. This led to the idea that even sugary beverages, free of fat as they were, could be consumed to our heart's content without influencing our waistlines. This was a disastrous misconception, but consumers in this nutrition, obesity, chronic disease world had no protection from bad science and its ubiquitous misapplication. Even Robert Atkins, who came to fame in this era and knew that insulin was a fattening hormone, still argued in his massively best-selling diet book that his LCHF ketogenic regimen worked so well because it stimulated some kind of fat-mobilizing hormone, a notion that had been proposed by British researchers in the 1950s and would never pan out. The reality is that virtually all hormones, with the notable exception of insulin, are technically fat-mobilizing hormones, although they won't mobilize fat when insulin is elevated. The insulin signal overrides that of these other hormones. When a New York City physician and a Harvard-trained nutritionist joined together to write and publish a scathing critique of Atkins's diet book in 1974 under the imprimatur of the American Medical Association, they pointed out that Atkins's fat-mobilizing hormone was a canard and described Atkins's diet as based on bizarre concepts of nutrition that clearly shouldn't be promoted to the general public. Then, as an aside to the fat-mobilizing hormone business, they noted that fat is mobilized when insulin secretion diminishes, that the Atkins diet, an LCHF ketogenic diet, did among the better jobs imaginable of diminishing insulin secretion, was not something the AMA thought should be mentioned. Footnote. Hildebrook got it mostly right, but as I said, she wasn't writing diet books. Here's how she summarized this science in her 1973 book. Fixation of fatty acids in the adipose tissue for storage depends upon a continuous supply of glucose, and inasmuch as insulin is required for utilization of this glucose, it is obvious that control of fat metabolism is mediated by glucose and insulin. The implication of this interrelationship is that the excess storage of fat, as in obesity, might be associated with, or is the result of, an overproduction of insulin and excessive intake of carbohydrate food, or both.